present Ian Carmichael as Lord Peter Wimsey in Have His Carcass by Dorothy L. Sayers, adapted for radio by Alistair Beaton, with Mariah Aitken as Harriet Vane and Nigel Stock as Inspector Umpletty. Episode 1, The Evidence of the Corpse.
The best remedy for a bruised heart is not, as so many people seem to think, repose upon a manly bosom. Much more efficacious are honest work, physical activity, and the sudden acquisition of wealth. After being acquitted of murdering her lover, Harriet Vane found all three specifics abundantly at her disposal. To be tried for murder is a fairly good advertisement for a writer of detective fiction, and Harriet Vane thrillers were booming. In the interval between finishing one book and embarking on another, Harriet Vane started off on a solitary walking tour along the southwest coast of England. The month was June, the weather perfect. On the morning of the 18th, she set out from Leston Hoe with the intention of walking along the cliffs to Wilvercombe, 16 miles away. It should have been a pleasant and uneventful way of passing a summer day. But by late that afternoon, Harriet Vane was to be seen hurrying along the Wilvercombe Road in search of help. When help finally arrived, it was in the unlikely shape of a spindly figure clad in stout walking boots and a pair of flapping shorts. As they drew close, Harriet hailed him imperiously.
I say.
Good afternoon.
Excuse me, can you tell me where I can get hold of someone with a car or a telephone? It's frightfully important.
Oh, I'm afraid I can't tell you. You see, I'm a stranger here myself.
Well, could you... That is, you see, there's a dead man on the beach back there.
No, really. I say, that's a bit thick, isn't it? A friend of yours?
Certainly not. I don't know him from Adam. But the police ought to know about it.
The police? Oh, yes, of course, the police. Well, you'll find them in Wilvercombe, you know. There's a police station there.
I know, but that's some miles away, and the body's right down near low watermark. If I can't get somebody along pretty quick, the tide may wash him away.
The tide? But it might be going out, mightn't it?
It might, but it isn't. It's been coming in since 2 o'clock, haven't you noticed?
Well, no, I can't say I have. I'm short-sighted, and I don't know much about it. I live in London, you see. The name's Perkins. I'm on a hiking holiday. I'm afraid I can't quite see what I can do about it. There don't seem to be any police about here, do there?
Well, if you meet anybody, would you mind telling them about it? A man on the beach with his throat cut.
His throat?
Yes, near some rocks they call the Grinders.
But who cut his throat?
How should I know? I should think he probably did it himself.
Yes, oh, naturally, yes. Yes, otherwise it would be murder, wouldn't it?
Well, it may be murder, of course.
Oh, I shouldn't think so, should you?
You never know. If I were you, I'd be getting along quickly. A murderer may be somewhere about, you know.
Oh, good heavens. But that would be awfully dangerous. Perhaps I should come with you till you find a telephone. To protect you, you know, and that sort of thing.
As you like. If only we knew how far it is to the next village.
That'd be darling. But I don't know if there's a telephone there.
Well, it's our only chance. Oh, I say, what about that man? Coming down the lane. Look over there with the camping equipment. Let's ask him.
What? I don't suppose he'll know any better than we do.
Well, I'll go over and ask him anyway. I say, could you tell me how near we are to Darley?
Darley? A few minutes farther on.
Is there a telephone there?
No, yes. At Hearn, the grocer's. Just across the other side of the green. You can't mistake it. It's the only shop there is.
Thank you. Oh, by the way, I suppose there isn't a policeman in the village.
No, there's no policeman living in Darley. They share a constable with the next village, I believe. He floats around on a bicycle occasionally. Anything wrong?
Been an accident along the coast. I found a dead man.
Good Lord. Well, you'd better telephone through to Wilvercombe.
Yes, I will. Thanks.
Not at all.
Come along, Mr. Perkins.
There was no need to stop and speak to him. I don't like the look of that fellow, and we're quite near the place. I came through this morning, you know.
I only wanted to ask if there was a policeman. We must hurry. There's no time to lose. I'm most grateful to you, Mr. Hearn. I'd almost given up hope of ever finding a telephone.
That's all right, miss. Most of the villagers come into the shop at one time or another to use the telephone, so you might say it's all part of the service.
Oh, I'd better tell Mr. Perkins I have another call to make.
Well, the gentleman who was with you, miss, he's gone.
Gone?
Yeah, he slipped away while you was talking to the police on the telephone.
Did he? How strange. Oh, never mind, no great loss. How long do you think the police will take to get here from Wilbraham?
Oh, shouldn't be much longer now, miss.
Well, there won't be much left to see by the time we get to that beach. It'll be high tide soon.
Ah, that'll be the call you booked to London, miss.
Oh, yes, thank you. Hello? Hello. Morning Gazette. Give me the news, editor. It's urgent. Hello. Yes, I am speaking from the village shop in Darley near Wilbraham. The dead body of a man was found at 2 o'clock this afternoon.
And that's the place, is it, miss?
Yes, that's the place, Inspector. The tide's in now, but when I was here, there was a large rock just over there.
That'll be the Flatiron. But there must be 17 feet of water over that rock by now.
Well, the body was on the rock. I collected some of his personal belongings, and then I took some photographs.
That was very sensible, miss. Not but what if you'd started sooner, you'd have got to a telephone sooner.
I didn't waste much time. And I thought, supposing the body got washed away or anything, it would be better to have some record of it.
That's true, Miss Vane. Now, you took several hours to get to a telephone. Did you meet anyone on your way into the village?
Yes. Yes, there was a hiker on holiday from London.
Huh?
He introduced himself as Perkins. Wasn't very much help, I'm afraid. Seemed terrified he might meet a murderer, so he came with me to the village back the way he'd come.
He wasn't much in evidence when I arrived.
No. As soon as I went into the village shop to phone the police, he just made off.
And was he the only person you met?
Yes. No, wait. There was a camper.
Huh?
A square-built sort of man wearing dark spectacles. He spoke well, not quite like a countryman, like a gentleman of the country sort. What I noticed especially was the tattoo of a snake on his right forearm.
Well, I'm sure we'll be able to trace those two gentlemen. But the first thing to do is find the body. You can't do anything about it now. We have to wait for low tide. That'll be 2 AM or thereabouts.
Hmm.
There's a chance, of course, that the body may get washed off the rock and come ashore somewhere. Hmm. I'm afraid you'll have to come along to the station with me, miss, and make a statement. Let's get back to the car. And then there's the personal effects, of course. And make a note of these, Sergeant.
Yes, sir.
One shoe, one hat, one cutthroat razor, cigarette case, handkerchief. Is that a lot, miss?
Yes, that's everything, Inspector. Oh, there's the film. You better have it developed as quickly as possible.
You seem to have done a pretty tidy job, miss. Anybody think you'd made a study of it, taking photographs and all? It's a miracle to me the way you handled it. Why, most young ladies would have run away, let alone taking these shoes and things.
Well, you see, I know what ought to be done. I write detective stories, you know.
There now. Vane. Harriet Vane. Yes. I fancy I've heard that name before.
Yes, I expect you have. I'm the notorious Harriet Vane, who was tried for poisoning Philip Boyes 2 years ago.
Oh, just so. Yes. Well, now, Miss Vane, I'm afraid we shall have to ask you to stay within reach for a few days.
Oh, I quite understand that. I suppose I'd better put up somewhere in Wilbraham.
Well, I don't think you could do much better than Clegg's Temperance Hostel. It's cheap and quite comfortable.
I don't care for temperance hostels. What's the best hotel in town?
The Resplendent is the largest.
Then the Resplendent is where you will find me. Can one of your men kindly run me over there? Waiter, some more coffee, please.
Yes, miss.
Good morning, Sherlock. Where is the dressing gown? How many pipes of shag have you consumed?
The hypodermic is on the dressing room table.
Peter, how in the world did you get here?
Car. Settled in at the Hotel Bellevue an hour ago. Have they produced the body yet?
Who told you about the body?
I nursed it from afar, old thing. Where the carcass is, there shall be eagles gathered together. May I join you over coffee?
By all means. Where did you come from?
From London. Like a bird that hears the call of its mate.
I didn't call.
I didn't mean you. I meant the corpse. But still, talking of mates, will you marry me?
Certainly not.
I thought not, but I felt I might as well ask the question. Did you say that they had found the body?
Not that I know of.
Well, I don't expect they will then for a bit. There's a regular sou'wester blowing great guns. Tiresome for them. You can't have an inquest without a body. You must produce the body, as it says in the Have His Carcass Act.
No, but really, how did you hear about it?
Salcom Hardy rang me from the Gazette. Said my Miss Vane had found a corpse, and did I know anything about it? I said I knew nothing about it, and the Miss Vane was, unhappily, not mine. Yet. So I buzzed off, and here I am. I brought Salcom Hardy down with me. I expect that's what he really rang me up for. Smart old bird, Sally. Always on the spot.
He told you where to find me, I suppose.
Yes, he seemed to know all about it. I was rather hurt. Fancy having to ask the Gazette where the pole star of one's own heaven has gone to. How do these things get into the papers?
I rang them up myself. First-class publicity, you know, and all that.
So it is. Rang them up, did you, with all the gory details?
Naturally, it was the first thing I thought of.
You're a woman of business. But look here, beloved. Bearing in mind that I'm a corpse fan, don't you think you might have let me in on the ground floor? All the details, please.
I'm tired of giving details.
Tell me all here and now, and I will organize your publicity for you.
Very well. I tell thee all I can no more. I'd set out from Leston Ho with the intention of walking along the cliffs to Wilvercombe. It's a beautiful road, and it was virtually deserted. Anyway, I'd covered about 8 miles when I decided it was time to stop for lunch.
What time was that exactly?
Just 1 o'clock. I looked at my watch.
As you came along the cliffs, you could see the whole shore?
Yes, including the rock where I found the body.
Was there anybody on the rock then?
I really don't know. I was thinking about my grub, you see. And I was really looking about at the side of the road for a suitable spot to scramble down the cliff. My eyes weren't focused for distance.
I see. Well, it's rather a pity in a way.
Yes, it is. But I can tell you one thing. There was nothing moving on the shore. I distinctly remember thinking that the beach seemed absolutely and gloriously deserted. Perfect spot for a picnic. I'm positive there wasn't a living soul walking or standing or sitting anywhere within eyeshot.
And then?
Then, I'm afraid, I dozed off. I've been reading Tristram Shandy.
The pace of Tristram Shandy is not so swift as to keep the faculties working at high pressure, what? How long were you asleep?
About half an hour. When I woke, I looked at my watch again.
What woke you?
A seagull squawking round after bits of my sandwiches.
That makes it 2 o'clock.
Yes.
Now, what about the corpse? Were there any wet stains on the shoes?
No, I'd have noticed that, because I took one of his shoes with me as evidence.
Therefore, he went dry shod to the rock. So, we only have to find out exactly when the sand on the landward side of the rock is uncovered, and we can tell pretty close what time our victim got to the rock.
Of course, how stupid of me. Well, we can easily find that out.
Tell me about the rock and the position of the corpse.
It's very big, about 10 feet tall, roughly triangular in shape. As I said, at first I thought there was seaweed on it, but when I approached the rock, I began to realize it was the figure of a man. I climbed up and, well, his throat had been cut from ear to ear. Once I'd got over the first shock, I collected some articles of clothing and took some snaps, so at least there'd be something to show to the police if the body were to be washed away. So I took his hat, a handkerchief, a shoe, his cigarette case, and... Oh, yes, then I realized there must be a weapon.
No weapon, no suicide.
Exactly. Well, the water was about 18 inches deep at the base of the rock by this time, but I felt around just under where he might have dropped a weapon, and I found a cutthroat razor. That was about as much as I could do, really. Oh, yes, I tried to take his gloves off, but, well, they were rather stained with blood, and I'm afraid I found it too distasteful.
And at the moment you were on the rock, there was nobody within sight?
Not a single soul, except a man in a boat.
Ah, a boat. Now, supposing the boat had come in when the tide was out and the occupant had walked or waded up to the rock.
That's possible, of course. The boat was some way out.
It all seems to depend on when the corpse got there. We must find that out.
You're determined it should be murder.
Well, suicide seems so dull. And why go all that way to commit suicide?
Why not? Much tidier than doing it in your bedroom. Aren't we beginning at the wrong end? If we knew who the man was, we might find he'd left an explanatory note behind him to say why he was going to do it. I dare say the police know all about it by now.
Possibly.
What's worrying you?
2 things. First, the gloves. Why should anybody cut his throat in gloves, The second point that troubles me is the weapon. Sal Cardi tells me the corpse had a beard.
That's right.
Well, why should a gentleman with a beard sport a cutthroat razor?
Bought for the purpose.
Yes, after all, why not? My dear Harriet, I think you're right. The man cut his own throat, and that's all there is to it. Yeah, I'm disappointed.
He is disappointing. Can't be helped. Hello, here's my friend the inspector.
Good morning, Miss Vine. I thought you might like to see how your snaps have turned out. We've identified the man.
No, have you? Mm. Good work. This is Inspector Ambleton, Lord Peter Wimsey.
Oh, delighted to make your acquaintance, my lord.
How do you do, Inspector? Do sit down.
Oh, thank you. I don't know that you'll find anything mysterious about this case, my lord. Just a plain suicide, I fancy.
We had regretfully come to that conclusion.
Oh, why you should have done it, I don't know. But you can never tell with these foreigners, can you?
I thought he looked rather foreign.
Yes, he's a Russian or something like that. Paul Alexis Goldschmidt, his name is. Known as Paul Alexis. Comes from this very hotel, as a matter of fact. One of the professional dancing partners in the lounge there, you know the sort. Age, 22 or thereabouts, unmarried, living in rooms, nothing known against him.
He didn't leave a letter for the coroner or anything?
We found nothing so far. And, as regards the coroner, that's a bit of a bother, that is. I don't know how long it'll be, miss, before you're wanted. You see, we can't find the body.
Yes, just as well you took those photographs, Sherlock, or we'd have had no proof there'd ever been a body.
Hmm.
It's annoying. We like to get these things tidied up as we go along.
Naturally. Well, I'm sure if anybody can tidy him up, you can, Inspector.
Oh.
You impress me as being a man with an essentially tidy mind.
Mm-hmm.
I will engage to prophesy, Sherlock, that before lunchtime, Inspector Umpletay will have sorted out the dead man's papers, got the entire story from the hotel manager, identified the place where the razor was bought, and explained the mysterious presence of the gloves.
Well, as for the razor, my lord, I think that's neither here nor there.
Yeah, well, I expect you're right, Inspector. However, if it ain't troubling you too much, I wonder if I might have a look at it.
Well, certainly, my lord. I'll get Sergeant Saunders to show you all the dead man's effects. And if you'd like to come along with me, you'll dodge all these reporters hanging about in the lobby.
This is the razor found by the young lady, my lord.
Ah, thank you, Sergeant. Has it been examined for fingerprints?
Oh, yes, my lord.
Any result?
Well, I couldn't exactly say, my lord, but I believe not.
Hmm. Well, anyway, one's allowed to handle.
Oh, what?
Ah. Well, apart from a slight crack in the ivory handle, it seems to show no very striking peculiarities. If there's any blood left on it, it'll be hanging about in the joint. The sea seems to have done its work pretty thoroughly. Ah, hat. Fair to middling, but not exclusive. Cranial capacity on the small side. Shape, a little more emphatic than is quite necessary. Brilliantine. Ordinary stinking variety. Deduction, not wealthy, but keen on personal appearance. Do we conclude that the hat belongs to the corpse?
Yes, I think so. The brilliantine corresponds all right.
Cigarette case. Ah, now this is different. 15-carat gold. Plain and fairly new, with monogram PA. And containing 60 resk. Yeah, the case is pucker, all right. Probably a gift from some wealthy female admirer. Handkerchief. Silk, but not from Burlington Arcade. Colour beastly. Laundry mark.
Laundry mark's all right. Wilvercombe Sanitary Steam Laundry. Mark OK for this fellow, Alexis.
Now for the shoe. Nearly new. Thin sole, foul colour, and a worse shape. Handmade, so that the horrid appearance is due to malice aforethought. Not the shoe of a man who does much walking. Made, I observe, in Wilvercombe.
Yeah, well, that's okay, too. We've seen the man. He made that shoe for Mr. Alexis, all right. Knows him well.
Let's see the sole again. Yeah, slight traces of salt water here. But none on the uppers. Inference, he walked over the sand when it was very wet, but did not actually wade through the salt water. Two or three scratches on the toe cap, probably got from clambering up the rock. Well, thanks awfully, Sergeant. You're quite at liberty to inform Inspector Umpletee of all the valuable deductions we've drawn.
Very good, my lord.
Oh, and tell the inspector that I shall be going to London today and return in as soon as possible.
Yes, my lord.
To London? Why London?
Obviously, I should have preferred to stay here and view the town. But let us make our way to the lounge at the Bellevue, order some refreshments, and I shall explain all.
Isn't it a little early for refreshments?
It is, to be sure, a little early, but I always drive more mellowly on a pint of beer. Shall we go? Now, Harriet, you will have observed that the razor is an instrument of excellent and expensive quality by a first-class maker, and that, in addition to the name of the manufacturer, it is engraved on the reverse side with the mystic word Endicott.
Yes, what is Endicott?
Endicott is, or was, one of the most exclusive hairdressers in the West End. He will, or would, hardly condescend to shave anybody who has not been in Debrett for the last 300 years.
Well...
Consider, first of all, the anomaly of the man who buys his razor from Endicott's and yet wears the regrettable shoes and mass-production millinery found on the corpse. Could a man who is shaved by Endicott possibly deliberately order, shoes of that colour and shape? A thing at which the imagination boggles. But to leave that distressing subject and come back to the razor. That razor has seen a good deal of hard wear. It has been reground a considerable number of times. Now, a really first-class razor needs very little in the way of grinding and setting, providing it is mercifully used and kept carefully stropped. Therefore, either the man who used it was very clumsy and careless about using the strop, or his beard was abnormally stiff. Or both. Probably both.
I see. Well, I didn't know all that.
But I suggest that a young man who had so much difficulty with his razor would be more likely to have changed over to a safety and used a new blade every few days. However, the first thing to do is to trace old Endicott and find out from him whether it was possible for one of his razors to have been sold later than 1925.
Why 1925?
Because that was the date at which old Endicott sold his premises and retired with varicose veins and a small fortune.
But he might have sold the stock.
That's what I want to find out. I'll have to be off now. And while I'm about it, shall I see about getting a marriage license?
Don't trouble, thank you.
Very well, I just thought I'd ask. I say, while I'm away, how would it be if you put in some good work with the other guests here? You might get hold of some gossip about Paul and Alexis.
It's very good of you to come up to my room like this, Miss Vane. I saw you with the police and all those reporters were talking and... You see, the hotel manager wouldn't tell me anything. I'm sorry, my name is Weldon, Mrs. Weldon. I've been staying in the Resplendent for some time now. Mr. Greeley, that's the manager. He knows me very well.
It's all right, Mrs. Weldon. I suppose it's about...
Yes, about Mr. Alexis. The chambermaid told me a horrible story. Oh, Miss Vane, please tell me what happened.
I'm afraid something rather beastly has happened. You see, I was down on the shore yesterday afternoon, and I found a man lying there dead. Oh. And I'm dreadfully afraid it's Mr. Alexis.
That's what I heard. Was it... Do you know... A heart attack?
I'm afraid not, no. They seem to think he did it himself.
Oh, he couldn't have. He couldn't have. He was so perfectly happy. He couldn't have done anything like that. How do they know?
Well, you see, there's a photograph.
Oh, show me the photograph.
It isn't very pleasant to look at.
Show me the photograph. I want to know.
If you insist, Mrs. Weldon, here it is.
Oh, God. Oh, God.
I'm very sorry. Come and sit down. Have a cigarette.
Oh, thank you. You're very kind. I'm afraid I'm giving you a lot of trouble.
Not a bit. I only wish I could help you.
You can. Oh, if only you would. I'm sure you're clever. You look clever. I'm not clever. I do wish I was. I think I should have been happier if I'd been clever. It must be nice to do things.
Yes. Yes, perhaps an occupation of some kind is a good thing.
But, of course, I was never brought up to that. I've lived for my emotions. I can't help it. Of course, my married life was a tragedy, but that's all over now. And my son, oh, you might not think I was old enough to have a grown-up son, my dear, but I was married scandalously young. My son has been a sad disappointment to me. He has no heart. And that does seem strange, seeing that I'm really all heart myself.
Suppose you tell me exactly what you want done, Mrs. Weldon.
Oh, yes, of course. You see, Miss Vane, I know absolutely that poor Paul couldn't have done anything rash. He couldn't. He was so utterly happy with me and looking forward to it all.
To what?
Why, to our marriage.
Marriage?
Yes, in a fortnight's time. Oh, we were so happy, like children. From the very first night I visited the hotel, we seemed to be drawn together. He was lonely, too. We were both exiles in our own way.
Oh, yes, he came from Russia, didn't he?
Yes, as a tiny boy, poor little soul. He was really a prince, you know. But he never liked to say too much about that. Just a hint here and there. He felt it very much, being reduced to being a professional dancer.
Of course, yes. You didn't have any misunderstanding or anything that might have led him to...
Oh, no. We danced together that last night. And he whispered to me there was a great and wonderful change coming into his life. He was all eagerness and excitement. He danced so wonderfully that night. He said, I may have to go away tomorrow, but I can't tell you yet where or why. We got engaged in February, but he suggested putting the wedding off till June. He felt that we ought to wait and try to overcome my son's opposition. You see, Paul's position made him very sensitive. I'm rather well off, and of course he hadn't a penny, poor boy, and he always refused to take any presents from me.
How long had he been in England?
Only a few years. He came here from America, you see, after his adopted parents died there. They gave him their own name of Goldschmidt.
I suppose he went to school somewhere.
Oh, yes, yes. He went to an ordinary state school in New York with those poor little East Side children. But he hated it. They used to laugh at him because he was delicate. They were rough with him. And once he got knocked down in the playground and he was ill for a very long time.
Then later he became a dancer.
Yes, yes, he worked very hard at it. But he had some trouble in one of his knees, arthritis or something, and he was afraid it would get worse and cripple him. Oh, dear. It seems we were fated to meet, and now... Oh, we were both so sad and lonely. We were going to be happy together.
It's frightfully sad. I suppose Mr. Alexis was very temperamental.
If you mean that he did this awful thing himself, no, never. I know he didn't.
You do realize, Mrs. Weldon, don't you, that if he didn't do it himself, then somebody else must have done it?
Yes. And I'm sure somebody else did do it. I'm sure of it, Miss Vane. I'm sure of it.
In that episode of Have His Carcass, the parts were played as follows. Lord Peter Wimsey, Ian Carmichael, Harriet Vane, Mariah Aitken, Inspector Umpletee, Nigel Stock, Haviland Martin, Warren Clark, Mrs. Weldon, Isabel Dean, Julian Perkins, Richard O'Callaghan, Saunders, John Webb, Mr. Hearn, Alexander John, narrator, John Westbrook. Have His Carcass was adapted by Alistair Beaton from the book by Dorothy L. Sayers and was produced by Martin Fisher.
We hope that you've enjoyed this recording, and for more happy listening, please visit OTR.